Hello, I'm Mallory Rubin.
And I'm Van Lathan.
Check out the Ringerverse podcast from The Ringer for all things superhero movies, nerd culture, and fandom entertainment.
We have instant reviews and fun takes on all the latest news and more, available now on Spotify.
This episode is brought to you by Max. The new HBO original limited series, The Sympathizer, is an espionage thriller and cross-culture satire that follows a communist spy during the final days of the Vietnam War and his new life as a refugee in Los Angeles, from executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., and based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Sympathizer is streaming now exclusively on Max. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more.
Chaos League time.
The chaos.
Hello and welcome back to the Stadio Podcast, Ringer FC. I'm Musa Kwonga.
I'm Ryan Hun.
Ryan, how are you doing?
I am good, thanks, man. How are you?
Very well indeed.
I need to tell you something.
What's that?
It finally happened.
Oh, what's that?
So after we posted everything for Monday's podcast, I put my jacket on, fired up some tunes, put my headphones in, went for a little walk, crossing the street in my neighbourhood.
Oh God, okay, yeah.
And
okay.
A gentleman approached me and said, "Are you Ryan?" I bumped into a Stadio listener.
Incredible, he found you.
Shouts to Felix, lovely guy. Just crossing the road, had a little brief chat.
Oh, that's so cool.
Mutual friend as well, which is nice. But yeah, there you go. So we can stop talking about it now because it's happened.
So funny, the moment of recognition. Oh no, what have I done? It's like
it's me being super proud of it, and Moose is just like bumped into Ryan? Three this morning. Anyway, shouts to Felix.
Lovely. Right, Felix,
let's do some admin quick. Right, his house went up on Wednesday. Flo joined Ian to chat to Jill Roard, former Arsenal, current Wolfsburg and Netherlands player. It was a really good episode. They also talked a little bit about Leah Williamson becoming England captain for the upcoming Euros. That's on the Ringer FC feed now. Other bits of admin, you were on another podcast quickly. Shout it out.
Yeah, Fire These Times with Joey Ayoub and Justin Salhani. We talked about sports washing, or as I'm starting to call it, death insurance, at the World Cup in Qatar. Prior to that, the background political context, yeah. So the Fire These Times, Joey Ayoub and Justin Salhani are both excellent follows on Twitter. If you're on Twitter, so please check them out.
Check theringer.com. All the other pods on there, I've been really enjoying, and I've shouted out a few times, but I've been really enjoying the Ringerverse Moon Knight catch-ups. Really good. Other than that, Stadio Outros plays on Spotify. And if you do listen to us on a podcast app that allows you to rate and review, please do so. Be very kind. And the most important admin of all, we hope everyone's staying safe and well wherever you are in the world. And obviously, getting that booster if you can. So today, as you may have guessed, we're going to talk about the Champions League.
We are.
So let's get into it. All right, man. So I know that there was so much drama this week, but if it's okay with you, I'd actually like to begin with in Munich, because I think that from the results of the whole round, Villarreal going through against Bayern over two legs, through to the semi-finals, the first semi-final under Unai Emery, the first semi-final since they've faced Arsenal back in the day in the Champions League.
06, yeah.
And in terms of an actual result, this was by far the most seismic of the round.
Mm.
This was actually quite similar as a tie. I think we mentioned it last week. Bayern were lucky against Salzburg to take a draw back to Munich.
Yes.
And actually in this tie, Bayern were quite lucky that the tie was only 1-0 at the halfway stage.
Absolutely right, yeah.
Villarreal really could have capitalised on more chances that they had in the first leg. And in the second leg, I think we expressed maybe that, you know, they could have got the Salzburg treatment. However, I think that they were a side that was a lot more capable of dealing with Bayern threats than Salzburg were.
They absorbed extreme pressure in the second leg, I would say.
Yeah.
Extreme pressure. You're right. They handled this. I mean, supreme. Just looking to completed passes, over 500 for Bayern and under 200 for Villarreal. So some idea of the balance of play. And Leroy Sané finally delivering the level of performance that you just expect from someone of that quality was absolutely superb in this game. It was extremely dangerous. But they absorbed that pressure so well, Villarreal. They absorbed it so well. One thing I want to say about this game very quickly too is this has implications for Argentina's World Cup campaign, because you now have, you had really Foyt and Lo Celso starting for Villarreal, who are going to be part of that Argentina World Cup squad, and they were extremely impressive. And you're now seeing, I think Argentina are going to send such a battle-hardened squad to that World Cup. They're going to be so difficult to break down and beat, because, you know, Bayern, I will give them some credit, they threw a lot at Villarreal.
Mm.
But what's so impressive about Villarreal is their ability just to take the sting out of games, to absorb pressure. Parejo and Capu, like in midfield, just unbelievable. And Danjuma breaking really well just to take the pressure off. So, yeah, this Villarreal, this is what you call, it's a classic. You know, I know I mention Red Star all the time, and it's embarrassing how much I mentioned Red Star Belgrade, but there was an element of Red Star Belgrade in the breakaway goal. And there was something about the way they absorbed pressure that felt very much a kind of like, this felt like a very old school mid-1990s Champions League victory on the road, if that makes sense.
From Villarreal?
Yeah.
It technically wasn't a victory though. It was a draw. Much like the Real Madrid-Chelsea game. You know, Real Madrid didn't win that game. Chelsea won the game.
This felt like a win. It felt like a chance. Do you know what it is? I'm still in the...
Well, I mean, because when you go through, it's going to feel like a win no matter what the result
is. But I'm still in the away goals frame. I'm still in the away goals frame of mind.
Yeah, but even if it was away goals, Musa, they still wouldn't have won the game.
Yeah, I know, but you're being that guy.
Debate me. Let's go on LBC and debate me. I think the thing about Bayern is that I saw Jasmine Baba post a bit of an analysis on the lineup and the selection, and I agree with her in the sense that it really looked like Nagelsmann had tried to kind of unleash wave after wave on Villarreal early on, try and get Bayern ahead in the tie, and then switch to a more balanced, maybe not conservative, but controlling kind of system. And I think that when Bayern didn't get that early breakthrough, I think it started to look not particularly great for them.
Yeah.
There were a couple of moments from Bayern that were just so, what's the word? So telling, and in that, you know, Lewandowski scores after halftime, wonderful goal, super clinical, basically exactly what we'd expect from Lewandowski, the Champions League top scorer this season so far. But then Thomas Müller had that one chance to make it 2-0, which for him was almost just like nailed on. I think Nagelsmann actually afterwards said, yeah, Thomas has got to score there.
He could have brought it down. He had so much time, he could have brought it down.
And Nagelsmann did say afterwards that tactically they got it right, which I thought was quite pointed in the sense that he's not completely wrong. Like, they had enough there in terms of control, in terms of opportunities to see off Villarreal.
They did.
But this is a Bayern that occasionally we've seen a few times this season when they're not as clinical as we've seen them before. And I wonder whether there's a little bit of complacency that comes into that.
And because of the league as well. When the draw was announced, Villarreal, they must have thought, we're in the semis.
I mean, they did. Salah Hamazic basically was on Bayern TV and kind of giggling with the presenter about the draw. And I think Villarreal cottoned on to that.
Yeah, wasn't there a comment about it, one of the players actually?
Yeah, Dani Parejo, he said this amazing thing where he said, you know, when you spit up in the air, it comes back on your face. Or something like that.
Brilliant. Yeah, yeah.
But I think he was one of Villarreal's great performers over the two legs. And then the goal actually to win the tie, to draw level in the game.
That was incredible. The way he built
that. Chukwueze came on as a substitute. But the counter-attack, because the move started on the edge of Bayern's box.
And the way that Parejo built it, yes, with the change of direction. That is... That change of direction by Parejo, when he got possession in his own third, and he was facing out to the left, checks inside to the right, and then looks up and rolls the pass. You know, it was
to Moreno, right?
That was incredible. Do you know what that reminded me of? I think it was Lo Celso. He laid it to Lo Celso.
Okay, but Moreno laid the assist, didn't
he? Yeah, yeah, but yeah, absolutely. So when he was constructing, the first person he laid it into was Lo Celso.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Lo Celso played that ball down the left-hand side to Moreno. Moreno then crosses it in for Chukwueze.
Absolutely. It reminded me of the goal in the Clásico when Busquets on the edge of the box and step like basically loses Modric on the edge of his own box. It's incredible. And then rolls the ball into the space that Modric has vacated for Rakitic to break, and they end up scoring the other end, Barcelona. It was the same level of playmaking. It was that good. It's that good. Well, they call it in, was it the pausa? They call it in Spain, the hesitation. And so Moreno squares it after getting from the Celso, and the finish from Chukwueze, which they noted on. Now this...
bounces it into the floor.
This is a deliberate, this is the one.
I think it's deliberate.
It's deliberate because the genius of the finish is, he's like, first of all, I've been watching Chukwueze for a while. Like, he's a brilliant player and super smart, right? Mm. It's the kind of thing he would do, like, at that moment. And if it's not deliberate, then you would go for the far corner. The angle he was coming in, you go for the far corner, right? Or you go to the near post. And he knew Neuer was coming in and he had to get over him. It's one of the great finishes, actually. You know,
yeah,
considering
in terms
the timing,
of trajectory, yeah. In terms of trajectory, it's really hard to just get that kind of trajectory into the top part of the near post from that angle of that pass on your left foot.
Yeah.
And also Neuer spreads himself quite wide in situations like that. You see him quite often, he will drop to his knees and make himself big or take like a really wide stance. And I genuinely think that he knows, or he's studied, well, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if he studied Neuer's positioning on one-on-ones.
Yes.
And
low star shapes.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And it completely just, that trajectory just completely bamboozles Neuer. You're so programmed to expect a certain trajectory of a strike or a certain kind of strike in a one-on-one finish, I think, that it's very, very hard to react.
You don't expect it at all.
You're essentially creating your own deflection.
Exactly. Very well said. It's one of the few things in football where you watch and go, that is generally the kind of thing only professional football can pull off. Because the type of technique you need for that is elite, actually. The first time I ever saw it was Van Basten doing it against Foggia or something. I remember going, nah, like, and then the only reason I believed it was possible is because it was Van Basten. So when I look at the player doing it, I look at the technique of the player and I'm like, yeah, that's just the kind of thing you'd pull off. So great finish for them.
That was it. Saw them through to the semi-final.
Shout out to Unai Emery because the management of this tie, it would have been very, very easy for a team to get despondent after the 1-0 and kind of go away and not bat in the hatches, but sort of to lose intensity. But the way they actually attacked, they had a couple of good opportunities, Villarreal, even with Bayern against them. And just so much credit to Emery for steering them through this knockout stage, getting to the semis. And, you know, he's been criticised for many things, but his sort of, I don't know if you call it a redemptive arc, that's a bit strong, but just really great to see him confirming, just reminding everyone, like, just why he's such a respected coach.
Yeah, we had a few questions, and one of them was from Arnolfo Aguirre, who said, are Arsenal fans to blame for Unai Emery's sacking after that performance against Bayern? Were Arsenal fans too impatient? And I think this was a common thing that you saw floating around Twitter, which, I mean, is Twitter, right? So, but my take on Unai Emery has always been, seems like a really good guy, seemed like he really cared, seemed like he took that Arsenal job with a huge amount of respect for the position that he was in terms of following on from a legacy manager like Arsene Wenger. I think in terms of who was available at the time, it made quite a lot of sense in terms of profile that Arsenal would go for someone like Unai Emery. In terms of the specific brief as well, I can understand it while also understanding that I don't think it was actually a fit.
The fit is the word. I'm glad you said that word. That's exactly it. Fit is the key.
This is something that we've seen at numerous places. Like, you know, I mean, you take Monchi, for example, at sporting director. Incredible sporting director. Goes to Roma. Really doesn't work. Goes back to Sevilla. Works again.
Right.
You know, there are just certain places that people feel able to work. And I think for Unai Emery, I think he was treated quite disrespectfully by a number of fans and a number of, not necessarily just Arsenal fans, but also certain people within the media because of the communication aspect. But this was a guy who turned up for his first press conference and attempted to the best of his ability to answer as much of it in English, despite clearly being new to learning the language. That takes a huge, huge amount of bravery, actually, because communication as a manager, especially when you're coming after someone like Arsene Wenger, I think we've talked about this before, so I'm going to keep it brief because I know we're repeating, but Arsene Wenger was such an elite communicator. His reputation probably would have benefited from doing the Bielsa and the first season Pochettino route by just having a translator there and just creating that barrier. I think he tried his best. I don't think he was the best fit. I don't think he's a dreadful manager at all. I think he's a very, very, very accomplished coach. And I think you're seeing this back at Villarreal. And I'm personally just very, very happy for him because I think he got a lot of quite unnecessary and nasty shit thrown at him when he was at Arsenal. And the two things can be true. He might not have been the great fit and he might not have been the best Arsenal manager. But still, I think that it really strayed into some territory that I just never really liked or felt comfortable with.
Yeah.
However, just because he's now got to the Champions League with Villarreal, that doesn't mean that Arteta is a fraud and Arsenal should have kept him.
Right, absolutely. That can all be true. I think what I would say about this is it is about putting respect on his name. That I think can be said safely. You have to respect someone that defeats this Bayern team over two legs. You just have to. It is what it is. Yeah. Yeah.
So congrats to Villarreal. Congrats to Unai Emery. Let's talk about Bayern very, very quickly, a couple of minutes before we move on. We had a question from Sleeping Nail who said, is Nagelsmann in trouble at Bayern? Even Kovac at least won the double in his first season.
No, because we said this would be a difficult season for Bayern. There was a lot to do. There was a lot of transition. There's a lot they had to do. And actually, if his primary brief was to deliver the league, which would have been, I think it's unreasonable to expect a Champions League in Nagelsmann's first season, given the quality of the front runners in the Champions League. He's there. He's probably going to win the league there. That's par for the course. They're out of the cup. That was a terrible defeat to Gladbach, but Gladbach have been streaky as hell. I think.
But they also had a really bad defeat in the cup last season to Holstein Kiel. So
right. So you take the league and you move. This is, I think, a slightly subpar season, I would say, for a manager of Nagelsmann's talents. But that also reflects the state that Bayern was in. Bayern was not in the easiest state when he took control. That has to be understood. He had to integrate new players. He's losing others. So yeah, I don't think his job is in trouble. He's one of the most talented young coaches in world football.
Yeah, I do think that there's potential for it to be a little bit more rocky over the next season or two with Bayern. They've got a lot of players who are out of contract to the end of next season. They've got a lot of players who will probably leave because they either want a new challenge or they want to get paid, and they can't do that at Bayern. Bayern are very much in the kind of like, I don't know, when all of your draft picks are coming up for the first max contract, you can't pay them all.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of rumours about Lewandowski wanting to go to Barcelona, potentially this summer. Serge Gnabry doesn't look close to signing a new contract. Obviously, Niklas Süle is moving to Dortmund in the summer. Dayo Upamecano hasn't hit the level of the peak time at Leipzig. I think the back end of his time at Leipzig was a little bit wobbly. And Hernandez is still very much a question mark for the amount that they paid for him. You know, he's by far and away Bayern's record signing. And Benjamin Pavard has not turned into the level of right back that you would expect Bayern to have.
Yep, he's regressed, if anything, yeah.
Yeah. So there is a lot to fix at Bayern, and also at executive level as well. I think at executive level, it's not rosy there. Salihamidzic, I think, has come under quite a lot of pressure. And a lot of it's self-imposed. I also think that Oliver Kahn taking over as CEO has not been unanimously popular or successful so far. There's a little bit too much noise at Bayern, but there is a big wave of these players. I think Neuer and Müller and all of these players are also potentially out of contract as well. And I think that there is definitely a rebuild and a reboot coming. They're kind of in between the two at the moment. And that, I think you've seen that in some of the erratic nature of their play this season and some of the erratic results.
I wonder if Nagelsmann was actually employed for the rebuild.
I think
in terms of assessing him, the time to assess actually may not be this season. I think it's the next couple of seasons he'll be judged on, and rightly so, I think.
Mm. Before we move on to the other game, should we just quickly shout out Liverpool going through against Benfica? Because
yeah, absolutely.
I think this was quite a... this was just kind of pretty much as I expected this game to be, maybe with Benfica scoring a few more goals.
Benfica's still tall.
Yeah, but also Liverpool heavily rotated. They've got a massive game at the weekend against City again. They had a massive game at the weekend just gone against City. I think a lot of people were trying to push Klopp for a little bit of spice after the game. And he was just like, we're into the semi-finals of the Champions League. What is that amazing line he said? If when I'm not happy about that, come and knock me out. Good luck knocking Klopp out.
Yeah, and also like, I said this before, like shout out to Benfica. I know that Liverpool did rotate, but they did show out. Yeah. You know, you go away from Anfield with a 3-3 draw. Like, I know there was rotation, but it's still Anfield.
Yeah. It was one of those kind of like glorious draws that everyone was happy.
Yeah. Teams have gone there and got absolutely coated with a substandard Liverpool team. So not substandard, but like a larger second string. Konate scoring again, which is quite nice for him because his mistake in the first round put, the first leg put Liverpool in a bit of trouble after his goal. So it's nice for him to kind of to square that circle. And Ramos with a beautiful finish and Darwin Nunez adding to his catalogue of fine finishes and surely boosting his eventual sale value a couple of seasons down the line.
There was an amazing stat about Konate. I need to find it. One sec. From Michael Reid, Ibrahima Konate is the first player to score both of his first two goals for Liverpool in different matches, but against the same opponent since Vegard Heggem against Middlesbrough in 98-99.
Oh my God, that's wild. I love that. Heggem. Great player.
I love stats like that. That semi-final against Villarreal, I think it's going to be really fun.
I mean, Liverpool should be aware that Villarreal can win the entire thing. I think this is the thing.
This is interesting because I think Klopp is not going to disrespect a side who have eliminated Juve and then Bayern in back-to-back rounds.
He's not. He's absolutely not.
And nor should he. But yeah, I think as we'll touch on the City Atleti or the Atleti City game in a minute, I think that I find it really intriguing to see two sides that play very different ways go up against each other in the Champions League. But yeah, let's take a quick break and then we'll do all of the drama.
Let's do it.
Okay, man, because I think it was most recent, do you think we should start at the Wanda?
Actually, yes, we should, because actually I don't want to leave the podcast with a bitter taste. Ooh. I'd rather end with Chelsea Real Madrid because this left a slightly bitter taste. So yeah, let's start with it.
It did. Yeah, let's start. I think you're right. 0-0 draw at the Wanda. Saw Man City go through 1-0 in aggregate. Go on, you can start.
Well, Atleti came out very differently how they did in the first leg and the first 20 minutes, but we knew they would. And the first 20 minutes of this match was more interesting than the entire 90 that we saw in the first leg. And that was by design. One thing Atleti maybe didn't get enough credit for in the first leg was how well they shifted the ball out of defence on occasion and pressed forward in some of their attacking play in this game. Was really enterprising and impressive and really quite enjoyable and had City in, I would say, a fair bit of trouble. The way they shifted the ball through midfield, Thomas Lemar looked, you know, really quite good. He's a player that I've always looked to. When he's going to have his breakout moment, it's not coming. He's just a good playmaker. Again, I think missing Carrasco as a starter, which made them lack a bit of thrust. And I've always been a bit ambivalent about Llorente playing as a right wing back because I feel you get more as an interior, but he added some really good attacking threat. And Joao Felix as well, just finding, you know, dangerous pockets.
He's been brilliant recently for Atleti as well, Joao Felix.
He's
on probably the richest fame. I think he's on the best goal scoring form that he's been at since he's been there.
Yeah, so he doesn't get as much of the possession as he should, but he still manages to be very efficient with it. So, yeah, Atleti were a new proposition, but Pep knew this. Guardiola knew it was coming. And this is the thing. It's credit to City that they played their game. And I have to say this as well. I love that Guardiola has just absolutely normalized playing three midfielders as a front three. Or three midfielders or sort of, you know, or no strikers. The fact that that's just an absolutely normal thing tactically. And that you have players like Phil Foden, who it will come to him in a moment, holding the ball high up the pitch, drawing fouls, and actually, like, I have to say this, rattling Atleti. It's not often you see Atleti...
Yeah, they were completely rattled.
It's not often you see Atleti forced to lose control in their own context, playing their own game, you know, but it's funny because Pep, you might say that Atleti play largely regressive, frustrating football. And I would say that Man City play largely progressive, frustrating football. And I've just never seen Atleti that frustrated before.
Atleti were fined before the game for a certain amount of fans showing some Nazi salutes in the game last week, I think.
Mm.
As well as the Champions League anthem getting booed, the taking the knee was getting booed, which is something we've talked about that happens at Atleti before, that's happened at Atleti before. And something that we've mentioned numerous times, that there is a large portion of that fan base that is extremely right wing. Some of the stuff that I saw about Atleti was just like, yeah, they don't play this way all the time, actually. And actually, over the last couple of years, like, I've actually seen more variation in the way that they play, not necessarily game by game, but as a whole sample size than quite a lot of other top teams in Europe, because we've talked about this quite a lot, how Atleti kind of opened up a little bit in that title winning season, and then they had injuries in COVID and they kind of panicked a little bit and they tried to go back to the old school way. It had already kind of felt like they'd pushed on a little bit too much to really tap into that mindset again. And a lot of the players who were from those vintage shithouse Atleti teams weren't really there anymore.
Mm.
They have by far the best squad in La Liga, or they did at the beginning of the season. I think Barcelona have closed the gap in terms of a squad, but I still think Atleti have the best squad. They've underperformed in the league this season. They've underperformed in a lot of key games. They have been quite frustrating because they haven't utilized the attacking tools. But I also think that tearing into Atleti in this tie in particular, we'll talk about what happened at the end separately. I'm talking about purely from a tactical point of view. Mm. I think is a little bit harsh because, yeah, they're not underdogs. Man City aren't playing Freiburg.
Right.
Atleti do have a large amount of revenue, but there's still a huge gap between Atleti and the very, very pinnacle of European clubs in terms of revenue. There's a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B. And I think if you combine quite a lot of the theory together, you kind of get somewhere near the truth.
Mm.
And actually, Miguel Delaney wrote a piece for The Independent today, which I think was quite a good summary.
Of everything, the entire context.
Everything.
Yeah, I thought so, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you would expect more from Atleti over the last year. Well, not over the last year, because they won the league, but I think in Europe over the last couple of seasons, you've seen quite a prime example of what we've talked about with Simeone, is that he kind of gets stuck. You know, it's like, you have all these ingredients in front of you. I'm going to use a Musa Okwonga cooking analogy. You've got all of these ingredients in front of you that you could make a super intricate, beautiful, high-end meal. You know, with lots of volume on the plate, like they like in MasterChef. They like volume.
Yes.
Height. They got a bit of height to the plate. However, there is a can of beans there. So you just make beans on toast. You know, even though you could do the rest of it because...
Yes, keep it pragmatic. You know exactly.
You make a killer beans on toast. So you're going to do it. So yeah, I think basically what I'm trying to say is... Go on.
I was going to use... So the volume, right? There's a pre... Remember that preseason match when Atleti absolutely destroyed Real Madrid? It's like 6-1 or something.
Yeah.
And that was the moment. That was the volume moment.
I think
that
it scared them.
That was the expansive... And I saw that and thought, my goodness...
Mm.
Joao Felix in behind Costa, of course, fitness was a challenge, but that configuration, Joao Felix, second striker in behind a roving direct nut, like a Darwin Nunez, for example.
Mm.
This is the Atleti that is the evolution. I saw that and I was like, wow, that's the future. And I think Simeone is afraid to embrace it because the moment the season started,
100%.
Nil-nils.
100%. Yeah. But what I mean by that is all of that criticism is completely valid of Atleti.
Yeah, yeah.
However, absolutely bashing them for doing that over two legs against Manchester City, that's not the one. For me, the results some of the results in the group stages, like the Milan game, deserve more criticism than playing this way against Manchester City over two legs. Because as we talked about with Real Madrid, the PSG tie, it's two legs, just hang in the tie. Real Madrid hung in the tie against PSG and they punished them in the second leg. And what Atleti tried to do here, while I don't think it was executed to absolute perfection, Atleti were a goal behind in a two-legged tie in their own ground with 45 minutes left. And you saw, I wrote a tweet about that variation thing, and I think actually this game was quite a prime example of it, because you saw early stages of the game, Atleti had a flat line of five at the back. In the last 15, 20 minutes, they had a flat line of five at the front. Now, I totally get the arguments that some people might say, yeah, but they were chasing the game at that point. Yeah, they were, but they'd shifted momentum to the point where even Pep said, like, City were in trouble, and City were really in trouble for a little bit. And then again, absolutely valid, Atleti become the architects of their own downfall by implementing tactics that they usually do when they're a goal up. They absolutely fucked it for themselves.
Yeah.
Going back to the beginning as well, like, Felipe should have been booked for the thing on Foden. He was absolutely correctly sent off for that. But then also Foden rolling back onto the pitch was absolutely genius, because A, if it doesn't kick off, he's on the pitch anyway, so you have to have a stoppage.
Mm.
And it just killed all the momentum dead. But the fact that Atleti completely lost it, this is why I actually don't believe that they are the masters of shithousery anymore at all, because no. Masters of shithousery channel it and they wouldn't lose it there.
I'm glad he said that. Yeah.
Do you know I genuinely think that Manchester City are smarter at implementing...
Grealish outsmarted Savage and didn't even come on the pitch.
Exactly.
Over two legs, Grealish psychologically dominated Savage.
Yeah.
He did it. Like, yeah.
This is where I think Atleti deserve quite a lot of criticism, because the stuff that happened after that, they'd got themselves into a position where they very realistically could have taken that game to extra time.
Should have, I think.
And actually, they had the chances to score definitely one, maybe two.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. No control.
Kenny Shields needs to look at this game. As many people have said, emotional men, too emotional.
Too emotional.
They were being too emotional, and they undid it for themselves. But they have this narrative. They still have this narrative. I know I've been talking for a while, sorry. But they have this narrative that comes from the early 2010s, when Simeone had taken them far beyond anyone thought that he would ever be able to take them when he took over. And I think this is why Simeone gets so much leeway at Atleti. He is essentially their Wenger. So what I'm saying is, Atleti, absolutely valid criticism.
Atleti choked on their own testosterone. They choked on their own testosterone. That's what this was. I saw it and you could just see, you know, the eyes are spinning, their heads were gone. The thing that Savage did in the first leg, he did it again. When he reached out and grabbed Grealish's hair, I was like, he's got you. Mm-hmm. That's the level you're navigating on. You are about to go out of a Champions League quarterfinal and you're reaching across to a substitute to grab his hair in an argument. You've lost it. Mm-hmm. You've absolutely lost it. There's no strategy to this. There's no plan. There's no like, haha. There's no Chiellini winding somebody up. There's no, you know, example. Like, I remember watching Juventus against, this is a bit of an old reference, but like mid-90s, right? Juventus played Nantes in the Champions League semi. Juventus marking at corners in the mid-90s in Champions League is a masterclass. The amount of things that are done, the amount of things that are done off the ball when Juventus are marking at corners in the mid-90s, you can imagine, you see those cathedrals and you have like angels, like the stone angels covering their eyes with their wings. It's like that. You just can't, the innocent can't bear to witness it. That is elite. That is elite, like, you know, dark arts defending. That's what we're talking about. What Atleti did was actually
quite stupid.
Yeah, it was a team that looked for the first time. I was like, you know what? People call your tactics out of time. And this is the first time I've looked at it and thought, you need a revamp here. I'd never thought that before seeing this. It felt like they reached into the bag of tricks and there was nothing in there anymore. And yeah, so, you know, a rubber snake came out.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Do you know what it reminded me of a little bit? It was like, you used an amazing analogy once when you were talking about Mourinho. And it was like when Pacino started to do the whole like, woo-ha thing. Like,
oh yeah.
And it's just not really scary anymore.
Yeah.
In this kind of tie against Man City, they weren't smart enough.
They weren't.
They were fairly close to executing it quite well, even though I don't necessarily agree with all the antics.
Mm.
They really had City rattled in a way that I've not seen many sides rattle them. City are very, very flexible as well in the terms of for example, I know a lot of people do talk about it now, but I still think City don't get actually enough credit for how much nous they have in terms of shutting games down. And also when they want to be, being a bit gnarly, like Phil Foden rolling back on the pitch. That's nous. That's a little bit of dark arts element. If it had happened the other way around, for example, same position and an Atleti player would roll back on the pitch, that would have been fucking uproar.
Yeah, yeah.
But City are almost like a very modern, very Pep way of, and obviously with huge resources, whenever they roll that kind of stuff out, you rarely see them lose it. It's channeled in such a controlled way. With Atleti, it's the opposite. Now, I was talking to someone about it yesterday and saying that actually, though, if you go through the team, they only really ever have like three, maybe four players at one time on the pitch who kickstart that stuff.
Mm.
If for argument's sake, and I know this is just like, well, yeah, duh. But if they had like Virgil van Dijk and David Alaba playing at the back,
right,
they wouldn't lose it.
No, doesn't happen.
No, they're so cool and stuff like that. And they have the controlled shutdown kind of thing. Felipe and Savic quite often. Savic, weirdly though, I mean, this is the weird thing. Like Savic didn't make a single foul over the two legs, which is just a wild
stat. Yeah, but
he kicked
Foden. Yeah, but well, the Foden one, the foul on Foden. I saw that and was just like, that's right there. A red.
Yeah.
Foden as well was brave. And
Foden was brave.
If you think of the playmaking function, like De Bruyne had taken off, Foden had even more creative responsibility. It was funny. I was watching some old YouTube videos of Foden, like, you know, back in the day when he's like 13, 14 years old. And it's hilarious because he's like half the size of his teammates in the youth team. He's like controlling the entire play. And it was a throwback to that, actually. Like, you know, Foden basically like not the biggest player, but in terms of mentality, just extremely tough.
Mm.
And weirdly enough, the kind of player who Simeone is relying on in the form of João Felix to knit together a team like that. And I suppose, you know, this is the tragedy of João Felix, that we're never really going to see him, well, maybe in his prime, in a free-flowing attacking team, certainly not at club level, maybe international level, but certainly not club level. But yeah, Simeone have questions to answer. And I wonder...
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think we've said this before, though, that maybe it might take a fresh pair of eyes on there. Like, for example, I think we said like a Pochettino.
Yeah.
You know, Pochettino's side's had a lot of that element in there as well. I know that sounds like an Argentinian thing. I'm not saying that at all. But, you know, Spurs had that really clever, gnarly element.
The profile of player. Yeah, the profile of player at Leti have is very much in the style of Pochettino's.
But also, I think he might be able to open them a little bit more in a controlled way.
Oh, he'd use Cunha a lot more.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what Simeone has struggled to do,
yeah,
weirdly, because the times when it's worked, it's looked really great. But I think what Simeone has really struggled to do is to open up Atleti regularly and keep the control. You know, for example, like they were the second top goal scorers in La Liga this season. They're the third top goal scorers in La Liga this season. So they score goals, you know, but their defensive record has dropped off a cliff this year compared to what it was over the last few years. So anyway, but also we've talked quite a lot about Atleti, but I think it was just quite good to talk about stuff like that, because there's, again, much like with the Emery thing, there seem to be like real binary arguments about Atleti. A lot, that's why I thought Miguel's piece was really good in the summary, because a lot of people are just like, I fucking hate these guys. And to be honest, I totally get it. I totally get why some people might see that kind of stuff in the Champions League and just absolutely be like, fuck this. If they were playing against a side I supported, for example, I'm not sure how you felt when they played Man United, but if they were rolling this kind of stuff out against a side you'd support, you'd be like, I hate these guys. But I think because of the reasons that I mentioned before, where we have, that isn't the only way they play. We think they should do more. It sounds really like fence-sitting nuance nonsense, but
they took us apart in the first leg. They took us apart in the first leg. They outplayed us, Ryan. They outplayed us.
Let's be real. Like, they were really, really, really good in that second half towards the later stages. So it isn't just this or that. I think the problem that they do have is just putting those two together. Even though they had a little bit of a wobble, Man City, they dealt with that so well. And they dealt with that thing at the end so well. They knew exactly what was going on and they dealt with it.
Yeah. This was the one, though, just before the pandemic broke out, this was the tie that Klopp didn't get through. It was the tie, it was the draw he was most afraid of. If City go on and win this whole thing, I bet they look back at this thing, the tie, that was the one that really got them worried. Because everyone knows what Atleti are going to give you over two legs. They gave it to United, it's exactly what they expected. They gave it to City and City withstood it. And that is hugely to their credit, I think.
Yeah, totally. I think from a City point of view, the real fear is the loss to, was it Cancelo and Kyle Walker?
Big problems. We know, like, when Pep got to, we know how important Pep's fullbacks are to him. The first season he was at City, his fullbacks couldn't do the work he wanted, and you saw his concern, because the way that Kyle Walker occupies defensively, like high up the field, the way that he occupies the fullbacks in that very, very specific way is so important for how Pep builds attacks, because you just lock down that side, it allows you to get involved with the playmaking function from the other flank. So it's a real problem for City that could cost them, and De Bruyne went off as well. So we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, it says Cancelo to miss the semi-final first leg, De Bruyne and Walker also out injured. I think from the left-hand side, while Cancelo is a huge miss, I don't think bringing Zinchenko in there will massively hurt City in terms of dealing with that Real Madrid right-hand side.
Mm.
It's the left that they worry. So it's the right-hand side for City that they're concerned. They need to be concerned about. I think Cancelo was always a huge miss, but I think in terms of what Real Madrid can offer as a threat down that right-hand side, I think Vinicius and Mondi on the left-hand side is a much bigger threat for City to deal with.
Yeah.
Before we finally move on from this game, we had a lot of questions about this game. Sorry, we can't get to all of them. John Squire says, is there a bigger lie in football than quote unquote disgraceful scenes no one wants to see?
There is no bigger lie because a lot of people wanted to see that.
there was a lot of the sickos meme going around last night. One from KKS Jareff about Cancelo and Walker, we've just mentioned that. Andrew Glynn with a little nod to a previous Musa Okwonga tweet.
Ha ha ha.
Was Atleti City a better second half than Madrid Chelsea? And we actually had the same from Alexander Marshall. Was the second half of Atleti City actually a better watch than the second half, maybe plus extra time, of Real Madrid Chelsea? No. We're going to talk about that game in a sec. So no, oh, wow. I don't.
No. I think I love the question, and also I would say Real Madrid Chelsea gave me all of my vitamins.
Yeah, we will talk about that in a second. Yeah. Joss Hedge says, is the Wonder the best new stadium in world football? I think it's in a shout for it. I've said Spurs' stadium, Tottenham Hotspur Stadium is there, but I think those two are the standard, actually.
And a shout for the Velodrome redesign. Velodrome's not new, but the redesign of Velodrome is stunning. Yeah. Stunning.
Any other questions on this? John Lyon said, how has Simeone negotiated such a mad contract? We kind of mentioned, I think it's because of where he took them from and to. Matt Pennington, Simeone on the pitch to calm Savage down, the most existential moment ever. This was genuinely incredible.
Absolutely futile act of peacekeeping.
Exactly. This is just purely performative.
Exactly.
Jacob Kahn says, please discuss Simeone's next level clapping to the end of the game. So much irony, emotion and appreciation all wrapped together. That was like watching someone play guitar with a harmonica and left foot is connected to the cymbal, right foot's connected to the bass drum.
I've got a question for you. How significant an act of foreshadowing was Pep coming out in that outfit?
Oh, we had roll neck Pep.
How significant an act of foreshadowing was that?
Dude, those two look like two, like, you know, Simeone in the all black suit, Pep in the all black get up with the roll neck. There was big evil energy from both of them. I think that's all the questions from that. All right, let's talk about Real Madrid, because they went through against Chelsea despite losing the game. I can't believe that this is the last game out of the four that we're covering on it, but that goes to show how good
these ties were. I was so excited by the draw. I think I said this actually when the draw was made, that I loved the look of it, and I stand by that. Real Madrid 2, Chelsea 3.
So close.
This is a classic Champions League tie. Absolutely classic.
Both legs, yeah.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable the quality that we saw. Can I say this as well? I've been evangelical about this configuration, this attack for Chelsea. I mean, I know they call it a front two. I always see it as a front three with Mount pushing up. Mount, Havertz, Werner is my favourite Chelsea front three. It's my favourite. And Kante Kovacic is my favourite midfield. So I look at this and just go, I'm already invested. I'm already emotionally invested because I love the way that those players combine. I have outstanding chemistry. I thought Ruben Loftus-Cheek really did really quite well on that flank. And we know that the Chelsea wing-backs have been a problem for them.
Yeah, Marcus, I think it was Ollie Glanville tweeted saying, you know, the reason why people might not think he's doing so well is because he's essentially doing three jobs.
Right.
And he allows so many other parts of that Chelsea 11 to function.
He's unlucky enough to cheat. Do you know what? Ruben Loftus-Cheek put in one of the best performances I've seen this season, but because it came in the 3-2 defeat to West Ham, it went under the radar. Yeah. But I loved it, the way that he stretched the play, linked the play, intercepted. So him playing on that flank, you know, seeing him there, I thought, actually, I like that, given how I've seen him slot in. And you know, the word utility player is kind of, the phrase utility player is, it kind of implies a player that's not that good at any one thing, but I think
we should reframe the utility player as multi-instrumentalist.
Thank you. I love that. That's much better. That's much better, because then you look at, it accommodates Fabian Delph as well. You know, players that really are so tactically smart, they can execute to a high level. You don't put just anyone on the flank at the Bernabeu, especially up against wingers like that, especially Vinicius, who's switching flanks, and the energy of Valverde. So really creditable start from him. And Chelsea is just, Brian, the intensity, actually. The intensity that Chelsea began with.
I mean, should we start at the beginning?
Yeah, because let's start at the beginning, yeah.
Chelsea were absolutely brilliant in that first half.
They were.
They were so good. They should have been a couple up before halftime, I think, but Mason Mount got a lovely goal. As we mentioned on Monday's show, haircut Mason Mount. Not to be fucked with.
As a friend of ours calls him Money Mace.
Money Mace. assisted by Timo Werner.
Who was outstanding.
He was brilliant. The last two games, Timo Werner has been superb. We'll talk about his goal in a little bit.
Real Madrid hate playing against Timo Werner.
They do. They don't like Timo Werner.
They didn't like it last year at all. Like, they hated it last year. Yeah.
And then Antonio Rudiger with another unbelievable header. Three amazing headers in this tie.
A fine performance.
One mistake over two legs,
but a fine performance.
But assisted by Mason Mount. Then Marcos Alonso has the goal ruled out for 3-0. And this is one of those where it's like...
Lovely finish.
It was a great finish. And it's just like... I really hate that these get ruled out, but that's the rule. Yeah. That's the rule. And it's super clear. And it's... Yeah, I get it. It's a bit like, well, can we not contextualize that rule a little bit? But I just don't think you can. I think actually having a rule that's so definitive, while you will get... the odd cruel
it
one
was
like this.
It was a handball. I saw it. The moment
yeah,
I saw
it. Was a handball. By the letter of the law, the way that law is written, can't really argue with it, even
and
though
it did help
sucks.
The control. That's the thing. It did help the control. I think it did help an element.
Spiritually not handball, but literally handball.
Yeah, it was very much so.
But then it didn't really matter because Timo Werner stuck him 3-0 up again anyway with an amazing goal. Like the commentator on DAZN called it "and Clashus's Timo Werner tour."
Oh my God! Lovely. Yes, yes. Can I say this about? We're going to get to the denouement, the end of this game, but just before we get to that point, up until this point, I thought that in midfield, Kante's ball progression and Kovacic, I love because he breaks the press like almost no other midfielder in world football, and people forget that the only reason Kovacic did not become a generational midfielder at Real is simply because he had Modric and Kroos in front of him in the queue. There are very, very few midfielders that could have kept him from becoming the player I think he should and could have been at Real. It's funny because he was kind of meant to be a kind of Modric replacement, then Modric didn't age. But what was interesting, if you saw that Modric positioning, you can see if Modric is basically happy and gambolling, you call it gallivanting. If Modric is gallivanting, it means the midfield's lost control. And if you look at Modric's positioning in this match, much more circumspect. He was like, we have to stay home to deal with the threat. And the moment, there is no coincidence at all, the moment that they gave Modric space in the final third, he offered up the game's most devastating intervention. A devastating intervention that changed momentum. It wasn't the winning goal that he provided, it was the equaliser, but I think everything shifted after that point because Modric became a creative fulcrum. So I actually don't think that Kroos had the worst game in attack. I think he moved the ball forward well. I think defensively he was really stretched. And we saw again, you mentioned actually before, and this is credit for saying this, Ancelotti's subs.
Changed the game.
Ancelotti's subs.
So it happened with PSG. It happened with PSG and it happened here. Like the weird thing this time was that Camavinga came on for Toni Kroos, who really didn't look happy, but afterwards he can't really have any complaints.
No.
But then Werner scores.
Nor could he against
PSG. And then Werner scores 2 minutes later? But in the overall context of the game,
yes.
Camavinga just injected such a much needed freshness and energy and guile in that midfield that I think Real Madrid hadn't really had up to that point. It kind of took them, you know, like the Bernabeu was super quiet, very nervous, and Chelsea was so superior that it kind of took Real Madrid until the 75th minute, maybe just a little bit before, to really start to wake up. I think it was actually.
Can I be honest as well?
It wasn't even really the Alonso goal.
Can I be honest? Not the biggest fan of Casemiro's positioning either.
No.
I think he's really wasted getting that far forward because he doesn't have the attacking guile of Modric. And I thought it was really strange watching him. Very often I saw him in the final third and I'm like, you're in the wrong place. And I think actually tactically, Ancelotti would have looked at that and said, well, to be honest, I'd rather have Casemiro rushing forward like that because it's safer having Modric. Modric is better defensively, weirdly enough, I think, in terms of positional sense. I'd rather have Modric deep and screening. I mean, we've seen Modric in this Champions League go back basically, he's been almost in a centre-back position. Like, he sweeps almost. Do you know what I love? This is the thing about Ancelotti's management of these games. There's a lovely masterclass that you see on, you know, the masterclass, the coach's voice masterclasses. And they ask him to, I think Rio Ferdinand's asking him to pick his Dream 11. And he goes for Modric over Seedorf. And Ferdinand's face is like, Modric, really? And you watch these ties and you understand why. He is like the WD-40 of Real Madrid's midfield. And I think Casemiro is a tough one because I don't think he was that impressive going forward, but it was kind of like the best possible fit. And Ancelotti is a master at, especially knockout ties, best fit. And like we said before, like Camavinga coming in really just liberated Modric. And it was the first time in 70 minutes Modric was allowed to have fun. And he was allowed to have fun for what? Half a second? He got possession, he looked up and he had fun. Outside of the right foot, the pass that he hit, I think Sid Lowe said later, I'm struggling to think of a better pass than Modric's. And I have to say, for the timing, the technique and the context of what he did, I struggle to think of a better individual pass at that level. Do you know what I mean? In terms of the timing, the execution, the difficulty, and what it meant in terms of the momentum, because the finish by Rodrigo, which was outstanding, and he's again a great sub for, you know, not the first time he's been a great sub for Real Madrid, won't be the last. The finish that he produced from that outstanding pass shifted the whole balance of the game. The other thing that shifted the balance majorly was the substitution of Timo Werner for Pulisic. Now, I absolutely hope that was an essential substitution by Tuchel. I hope Werner had to go off because if he didn't, I think it counts as a major mistake. I don't like to criticise Tuchel because his coaching is just, you know, exemplary. I will say that the threat that Pulisic offered, you felt the intensity just drop after he left. And then Pulisic missed an outstanding chance deep in injury time.
Yeah, and then Jorginho had that other one as well, didn't he?
But the Pulisic chance, you know, we've said this before, like Pulisic's career could have turned on two major moments in the Champions League. One was the 2-0 to seal the Champions League final. They won it anyway. But this could be another major moment, which is a sliding doors moment, because Pulisic absolutely should have scored that. A player of his technique and his speed and his timing, that's the win. And it's weird, didn't get that much discussion actually after the game, strangely enough, because I think it was sort of, you know, drowned out by the Benzema goal, which was the one mistake Rudiger made over two legs, which was the slip. Rudiger slips. I hesitate to call it a mistake. What I will say is, Vinicius, again, that combination is so funny. If someone said to you 2 years ago, Vinicius Benzema would be the crucial combination for Real, given how Benzema was talking about Vinicius, you'd have laughed.
Speaking of Vinicius, he tweeted at Reece James after the game saying, like, great game, bro, good luck.
Loved it.
I tweeted at halftime that after, like, I thought Reece James was really harshly booked for that one in the first half on Vinicius. But the way that he defended Vinicius after that was absolutely elite.
Can I compare it to something? It's like when Ashley Cole got done by Cristiano Ronaldo and thereafter knew exactly what he was doing.
Like, Reece James, really, in the rest of that first half, he shut down that right flank to such an extent that Vinicius had to, you saw Vinicius drift out to the right-hand side, I think in the second half, a little bit, because he just really wasn't getting anything from Reece James.
Getting no change at all,
And if you think about it, Vinicius Jr. going up against a right-back who's already been booked in the first, what, like 10 minutes of the game, you're like, uh-oh. And Reece James was so good. So good. But I also think this leads into a little bit what you were saying about Ruben Loftus-Cheek. I think the work that he did down that Chelsea right-hand side as well, I think helped Reece James out quite a lot. And I think that really worked in minimising the Real Madrid left. Like, we talked about it, that's where Manchester City, that's going to be the most dangerous thing for Manchester City to deal with in terms of the flanks with the missing fullbacks. The left-hand side is definitely the one. But Chelsea, I thought, did amazingly well at that. And Chelsea had the chances to win this game. The fact that they were so commanding in Real Madrid's backyard after seeing what Real Madrid have done to teams in the Champions League this season, it's not going to make them feel any better. But they can take such a huge amount of credit from that. I don't know. This is one of those like heroic defeats in a way, because it's...
There's no such thing as a good defeat, but there are better defeats than others. Pep wanted no part of Chelsea over two legs. You can guarantee that.
But I mean, what a game of football. And what a tie is a spectacle.
You could argue the last two ties, Real have been, for the majority of both ties, the lesser side.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And they found the resolve to hang in there.
They're like those sides that end up in the NBA finals and they've only actually outscored the opponent in like one quarter per match.
Do you know what they're like? They're like the early 2000s Detroit Pistons. Like,
well, maybe that's Atleti, no? Or that, they, it's the
a bit hard. Actually, yeah, Atleti's a bit, actually, that's a bit hard to call Detroit because they've got more attacking tools than Detroit in 2004. And that, yeah, it's true. This team is not built primarily on defense. So that's slightly unfair on this rail team.
Yeah, they've been in both the round of 16 and the quarterfinals for the majority of the tie. They haven't been the better side, but yet they're still through to the semifinals. And this is very reminiscent, I think, of, I think in less dramatic fashion, maybe from as memory serves me, but that run of the three back to back where you're like, how are they here?
It must feel similar to Modric and Benzema. And the thing is now, when you have Alibert in the mix, who's someone who's done that, this is now where championship pedigree, and it's an overused phrase, I think, but the pedigree starts to come through. The game management and the understanding of having been here before, this stuff all starts to really matter, I think. It starts to really matter. But yeah, great tie.
Amazing round of Champions League.
Yeah. No notes.
There we go. And we're recording this ahead of the second legs in the Europa League, which I'm very, very much looking forward to.
Sure.
Obviously, Eintracht going to Barcelona after that amazing first leg performance. All square in that one. All square in Lyon and West Ham. Braga taking a 1-0 lead to Rangers. And all square in the Atalanta-Leipzig tie as well. So they, all of those are extremely finely balanced. And then in the Conference League, you've got probably the best new rivalry in world football, which is Roma-Bodo Glimt.
Oh my God, amazing.
3-3 in Slavia Prague and Feyenoord. PAOK hosting Marseille, being 2-0 down in 2-1 down in the tie. And then PSV hosting Leicester, it's 0-0. They're all of them are set up. European football is amazing. It's just a shame that UEFA have decided to fuck around with the Champions League.
And change something that wasn't broken. But yes. Still, we move.
Other news, Erik ten Hag has apparently agreed a deal in principle to take over as Manchester United manager, but we're going to deal with that when it's all been made official because there's way too much to get through at the moment without that.
There is indeed.
All right then, in that case, shall we bounce, Musa?
Let's do it.
We hope everyone's staying safe and well. Obviously, getting vaccinated if you can. Don't forget to check Righty's House. Don't forget to check theringer.com. Don't forget to check the Stanio Archers players on Spotify. Speaking of which, we're playing out on Premonition, track called Don't Act Like a Fool. Especially when you're chasing a Champions League tie.
Exactly that.
Anything you want to add, Musa Kwonga?
Yeah, just less Savage, more Modric. If you're chasing any dreams, less Savage, more Modric. That's all I'm saying.
Wow. All right, everyone. Much love. Have a lovely weekend. We'll be back on Monday.
Yeah, see you then.
I've shared in the past. Now you want to take your love and go. Girl, go move on and try to run if you can. After telling me this is the end. Well, I guess it must be true. Said love sometimes will make you act like a I'm wasting my time trying to make you change your mind. So why'd you turn and take your love away from me? There's something I'd like you to keep in mind. Now you finally lost your cool.